you are tuning in to Awani Review with me, Cynthia Ng. Today, we are recording from the office of Roche Malaysia. Roche is a global leader in pharmaceuticals and diagnostics. And today, we will be discussing a very crucial topic on women's healthcare. Now, despite women making up about half of the global population, women's health is still significantly under-researched and underfunded. So today, to talk more about this with me on the show is Deepti Saraf. She is the General Manager of Roche Malaysia. Thank you so much, Deepti, for taking time to talk to me about this, and thank you for having me at your office.
Well, thank you. You're welcome to Roche offices anytime, and thank you for having me on your show.
I'm really excited to talk about our topic today, which is women's healthcare, but let's take a moment to get to know you a bit better first. Can you walk us through what motivated you to pursue a career in healthcare?
Well, during my time, Cynthia, and I'm sure it's true for Malaysia as well, I think there were only two professional courses that were recognized well, which is either become a doctor or become an engineer. And obviously, I was more interested in the biology and side of things. So healthcare was always something that was top of my mind. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to be doing something that is closer to people and impacts many more lives. Mm-hmm. And wanted to give back to society. So clearly healthcare was something that brought all of this together for me. So that's how I chose healthcare. I think women's health became a very, very important topic for me right during COVID. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard of all the statistics around women's health. And of course, I had heard about it too, right? You know, how women in healthcare do not receive the same kind of care. There are challenges in accessing care. There are only 5% of global assets are dedicated to women's health. But I think it became real for me in COVID when my own mother suffered with cancer or was diagnosed with cancer during COVID. And I saw the journey very closely, even mm-hmm. though I was far away physically, but I could, you know, see how the challenges were. We had to, you know, she obviously ignored her symptoms for quite some time because during COVID she wanted to take care of the family and, you know, everything else. So she ignored the symptoms like any other woman would. We always prioritize our life and our work and our family, our dogs, everything else is more important than your own health. But when she did take it seriously, it took us about 6 months to get her diagnosis right and about 4-5 hospitals with 7 doctors. And even though she got the best treatment at the end of the day, she still lives with symptoms. She's cancer-free now, but she still lives with some kind of side effects and adverse events that have happened during the cancer treatment. And so her quality of life has definitely been impacted after that. So it just sort of brought me so much closer to the real challenges that women face during cancer. There was nobody to give her suggestions or advice or how to take care of herself. And then when I was in Malaysia, my first visit was in the East Malaysia General Hospital for cancer. And I met women there who were dropping out of treatment because mm-hmm. they just couldn't afford to travel. And even though they knew the challenges and the consequences of dropping out of treatment, they chose that over continuing treatment. And so this became like really personal to me after that. And as a woman from Asia, I know one day I'm going to be part of the healthcare system to receive this delivery, right? And my daughter will receive this as well. So I really do want to make a change and a shift. We cannot live with the statistics where cancer for women is growing at an alarming rate, even in Malaysia. And even more debilitating is the fact that while cancer incidence is growing, cancer mortality continues mm-hmm. to grow at 40%. And the biggest challenge is that young women in Asia, especially young women are the ones who are getting affected with cancer. So obviously we can't live with such statistics. So it became very, very personal and very close to me, and I really want to make a shift in women's cancer care in Malaysia.
Well, let's talk more about that. You've highlighted some really big challenges such as accessibility to healthcare, healthcare cost, and also diagnosis and screening for, like you mentioned, cancer. What are some of the consequences? Let's talk about that first, right? What are some of the consequences if we do not address this? And what have you seen the direct impact to the outcome of women's healthcare if this remains severely underfunded and under-researched?
economically speaking, I think we are losing about many women from the healthcare system or from the economy, from the productivity because of these cancers. So, you know, about 800 million women across the world suffer from diseases that can be prevented. Imagine if these were working in the economy. And we know that if investment is made in cancer, $350 million can give us $14 billion worth of productivity back. So the impact is that we are losing economically, we are losing productivity if we are not investing and if we are not doing this right. We are losing women from the workforce and we are losing women from the economy if we do not do this right. And then, I mean, you take care of women, you take care of the family, you take care of the society, you know, you take care of the country. So I think we are losing all these women to diseases that can be prevented. Like cervical cancer can be completely prevented. Breast cancer, if diagnosed early, people can live a very, very long, healthy life.
Well, let's dive further into some of the things that you mentioned. For instance, accessibility to diagnosis and treatment, right? What are some of the reasons do you think still pose the biggest challenge for women to access this kind of very crucial healthcare needs? I know, of course, poverty affects everyone, but women are disproportionately affected compared to men.
Yeah, I think there are three big reasons, if I can say that. I think knowledge is one of the biggest challenges. I think education or health literacy is a big missing area for us in Southeast Asia or in Asia, and then in Malaysia as well. There are lots of myths, there are lots of belief systems that are culturally related to this. So when I say knowledge, I just don't mean educational knowledge, but you know, the kind of myths that we have, we need to, you know, we need to demystify them. I think there's a lot of taboo around getting diagnosed with any kind of gynecological cancers. So I think those are like the key challenges that I see from a knowledge perspective, and not enough health literacy in the system. The other big challenge is the decision-making power in our cultural system. Even though women make globally most of the healthcare decisions for a family, I think when it comes to spending on healthcare, when it comes to making a decision for their own healthcare, they're often dependent on the decisions of their husbands and their family. So I think that's a big challenge, especially in cases of cervical and breast cancer, the fear of losing a breast and therefore being ostracized from the family could be a big challenge. So I think besides knowledge, the decision-making power is a big challenge. And I think lastly, it's the economic burden, right? To a family, leaving children behind, you know, leaving the daily wages behind. And then, of course, the accessibility, you have to travel quite a bit, and the cost of care, the cost of high quality care, I would say, is a big challenge. So I think these are the three big reasons where I feel like women sort of drop out of the system more often than not.
I know, I mean, you've painted the picture, and it does sound really daunting for, you know, women and healthcare accessibility and care. Let's talk about then some of the solutions. So if you look at, you pointed out earlier, if you look at funding to research for women, the money, 4% of to 4-5% of global R&D spending goes into women's healthcare. So it's still seen as a rather niche set under the healthcare banner. So when we talk about solutions, where do we start? Number one, in terms of improving care and also accessibility to help women.
Yeah, I can talk about this all day, but let me highlight a few things, right? Firstly, why is there a lack of funding? Let's firstly understand that. I would say that till about 1990s, women were excluded from clinical trials. So imagine that most of the medicines that you're taking today, Cynthia, they have not been tried on you or any female body. So these are all male clinical trials, and we don't know if this works as equally in women as not, or not. So for a long time, there is lack of data. There is lack of understanding of the female biology and how drugs actually work on women. And since women have been excluded from research for a very, very long time, it's difficult to understand what works and what doesn't work. Because of this lack of data, there is lack of funding, because you know, every funding requires you to have a very clear model on what are you trying to prove. And because there is not enough data, it becomes difficult to prove that investing in women's, you know, care would bring that kind of money. there are lack of animal models, because most of the drugs are used first in animals to see if they are safe. There are not enough animal models that actually mimic a human female biology and hormonal systems. So these are the reasons where, you know, the really deep reasons in science that sort of affect us, but the main reason is that we've excluded women from cancer or from any kind of research for a very, very long time. In fact, if you go back in history, the female body was considered the mutilated form of the male body. The diseases of the female body were considering as the diseases of the wandering womb, and the word hysteria and women's hysteria came from there, right? So there's it's deep rooted in history, and why we do not have enough data and research.
Right. Well, I'm hoping that this conversation will take a positive turn, and then we can talk about what are the improvements happening, and have the statistics be more positive. And when we talk about clinical trial, women were excluded back then, but are we seeing a shift now in the global healthcare system?
We are seeing a huge shift, and I am thankful for multiple organizations such as WHO, World Economic Forum, you look at cancer bodies, NIHs across the world that have actually taken a huge step in saying no more can we ignore women from the healthcare systems. And so everyone, if you look at all the big global agencies, they have taken a step forward. Mm-hmm. So I think we are seeing a huge positive change in how women are treated in the healthcare, or how research is being done for women's mm-hmm. healthcare. The uprising femtech revolution, right? That is changing another, how technology can support women's healthcare and accelerate the pace of women research. I think what's really needed for countries such as Malaysia or any healthcare system is to look at women-centered, care. Mm-hmm. And what that really means is that women feel confident in sharing their symptoms, sharing what they're feeling or what they're suffering with. This requires that the healthcare system trains appropriately their healthcare force, their healthcare workers, in giving enough time to understand women's problems, to understand women's issues. The second big thing that would be needed is an end-to-end approach and an integrated approach for women's care. So right now what happens is screening is happening in one place, mm-hmm. diagnostics is happening in another place, treatment is happening in another place, which is not something that's easy and fast enough for women to access. And given their roles in society, I think you need to change that. So women need more decentralized care, mm-hmm. care closer to home, care closer to community, and more an end-to-end approach towards the pathway that you mentioned, right, from screening till diagnosis and monitoring. So I think one has to look at that. And then of course the third big element is bringing together a lot of women stakeholders and amplifying the voices, mm-hmm. making sure that there are more women CEOs, there are more women decision makers in healthcare. And I'm really thankful Malaysia has for the first time a female healthcare minister, right? So I think these are steps in the positive direction, because this is what will make a shift in women's healthcare.
Well, you've pointed a very good point, which is women in healthcare leadership. The numbers are quite staggering, actually. If you look at the global healthcare workforce, 70% are women. But if you look at the leadership positions, I think WHO's figure was only 25%.
Correct.
Of leadership position. And this imbalance, clearly, it will leave women out of the conversation, or less than equal say when it comes to allocating funding, allocating resources, and also this the conversation, what's important. Do you feel that things are shifting to correct this imbalance? Do you see more companies stepping up? You can speak about Roche as well, what they're doing.
Yeah, so for Roche, D&I is part of our big KPIs. We do not get bonuses if we do not achieve our D&I goals, which includes female leadership, mm-hmm. Which includes female in the workforce, and which includes female from underrepresented markets also being part of our leadership team, so that we have a fair mm-hmm. balance. So it's a big part of our KPIs. But besides this, we have multiple forums and platforms where women networks are formed so that women's voices can be heard more heard more, seen more, and the voices are amplified. And I think women need tribes, right? You need to make sure that there is a tribe that exists for women. So we are putting in place a lot of these kind of initiatives that support women's care. We are ensuring that there is parity in our salary systems. And I mean, I'm proud to say that it's extremely transparent, extremely fair, that in the way Roche offers this. We also ensure that women require some flexibility in their working, you know, and especially during their maternal, you know, when they are reproducing in a way. So we are making sure that the females in our offices, in our companies are given enough time, and we have flexibility in how they work during this time. We are not making sure that they drop out of the promotion systems. Mm-hmm. So these are all different policies that we have put in place to ensure that there is stronger female leadership.
Okay. Can I also then ask about having more women in leadership position? How has that impact Roche's businesses in pharmaceutical and diagnostics? Have there been more research that goes into women's healthcare because of having more women at leadership positions?
Actually, that's absolutely true. So our CEO is a woman as well. What this has brought for us is in the last few 5 to 6 years, we have prioritized women's healthcare, and we are creating this women-centered care approach. Mm-hmm. We are working very closely with World Economic Forum, etc., to understand what can be done globally. So there are two-pronged strategies that we are doing in the last 5 years because of this focus and because of the fact that we have female leadership. So two things have happened. Our R&D really is looking at pipelines and unmet needs in women's cancers, women's gynecological issues such as endometriosis. Again, 190 million women across the world are affected by this disease and not many treatments. Women drop out of workforces because of this, and again, no investments. So Roche is prioritizing research in and making sure that these diseases with unmet needs are researched thoroughly. We are making sure women are included in clinical trials. Any trials that we do should have gender parity. And lastly, we are looking at how can we then, when we go to the markets, when we are in the countries, what does women-centered cancer care or, you know, women-centered healthcare look like? And we are working with partners across the world to deliver that. So we have partnerships with multiple stakeholders because Roche alone can't make this change. So we're bringing together a lot of people, a lot of NGOs, a lot of people with similar visions, a lot of other industry partners to make a shift to make sure that healthcare is women-centered.
Now, speaking of vision, Deep Tia, of course, you're very passionate about this topic and this subject, and this is your life work, right? Can you talk to us about your vision then, you know, being in a company that is very focused now on women's healthcare? What do you hope to see? What positive outcome would you hope to see from the efforts that have been put into improving women's healthcare?
For me, I think, I mean, maybe because I'm working in Malaysia and I'm Malaysia-focused right now, I think what would be really important for me is that we have policies in place that do sustainable financing for women's healthcare, and specifically not just look at the reproductive diseases and fertility-related issues, which is what most countries prioritize anyway. Right. We always look at this part of the women's life, right? Like, how can we be fertile? But I really do want to say that there are many, many diseases which are very high burden on women. There are mental issues, there are cancer issues that are sometimes deprioritized. So for me, what would be important is that we look at a woman holistically, not just for their fertility and reproductive angle. So for me, sustainable financing in women's cancer care, which is one of the highest burden, especially breast and cervical cancer, and policies that support end-to-end treatment, holistic treatment, that would be the vision. Like, how do you get that? And how do you start a movement that will enable us to get there? That's something that I'm really passionate about.
And also speaking about that, the needs of women in different demographics are very different as well. Can you speak to us about that a bit more, in specifically to Malaysia, and what are the trends that you're seeing when it comes to diseases affecting women?
Yeah, so I think women in urban areas, and that's perhaps one of the reasons why there's a huge, we see about a 40% increase in breast cancer till 2030, mortality also going high in this space. Now, these are diseases which are related to stress and which are related to women being in the healthcare, in the workforce, mm-hmm. right? Women doing dual roles in the society. I think while women have stepped up when it comes to bringing in money into the family, they have continued to remain the, you know, the ones
primary
who take care
caregiver.
Of the, taking care of the home, the family, the children. So I think it's a very, very daunting task for any human being. So it has led to stress-related disorders, and there's a huge rise in women. If you look at breast cancer, cervical cancer, lung cancer, you know, lung cancer is often associated with smoking, but actually more women who are non-smokers are affected by a disease like lung cancer. And then of course you see diseases which are like endometriosis, etc. So I think there's a huge rise in diseases related to women, and that's a big trend. While women are wanting to prioritize health, there is not enough time. So what's really needed is care closer to home, closer to their offices, closer to the community. So how can you bring screening and healthcare to women mm-hmm. rather than making them go to these healthcare right. services? Whereas in a rural setting, I feel the challenges remain the same largely. I think cervical cancer is on the rise with our kind of society where early marriages, child marriages, early childbearing results in, again, 38% increase in cervical cancer, and mortality continues to be high. What's even more striking for a country like Malaysia is more younger women mm-hmm. are getting affected by cancers. So I think it's important that we nip this at the bud, and you know, it's already huge for us, and we need to take action. I don't think women's health can now be seen as something to be ignored, right? 50% of the population is women. They are bringing a lot to the healthcare system, to the economy of the country. And I think sustainable policies have to be in place mm-hmm. to make a shift here. So,
and how do you propose that sustainable policy? You earlier spoke about decentralizing healthcare and bringing healthcare to the doorsteps, well, not quite literally to women, to be closer to women. Have you seen any models around the world that have proven to be successful and could possibly be emulated by a country like Malaysia?
Yes, so most of the advanced markets have screening very, very close to home, and there are mandatory, sort of almost mandatory KPIs that the healthcare system is measured on. Mm-hmm. Also for the population, right, insurance and coverage is only given when women have diagnosed and screened themselves right. regularly. In Africa, we have put together something called as Empower Clinics. Empower Clinics are clinics where they are closer to the community. We have shifted the primary healthcare into diagnosing and screening cancer kind of diseases early on for the community. Whereas today's primary healthcare in Malaysia largely focuses on infectious diseases.
Right.
The aging population and the diseases of 2030 are mental disorders, diabetes, cardiovascular, and cancers. How can you strengthen the primary healthcare system to be able to diagnose and screen them better? So in Africa, we have actually working with the Blind People's Association. Mm-hmm. We've trained the blind men and women to do clinical breast examinations. So they go door to door. They clinically examine the breasts for women because they are blind, the taboos are a little lesser, and then they navigate the patients to the clinics. So making sure that they don't let the patients drop out of treatment. So once diagnosed or once there is some kind of a suspicion of a disease, they're brought to the Empower Clinics where right treatment is given to the women. So patient navigation is such an important, and that's a model that's working. And so I think it's something that we can, with public private partnerships, I think we can make a huge difference here.
That's the first time I'm hearing that patient navigation and that approach, but it's certainly really fascinating of the kind of methods that we can use to help improve women's access to healthcare. But in the couple of minutes that we have left, DT, I do want to talk a bit about tech. Like you mentioned femtech earlier, which I didn't have a chance to really get into.
Sure.
We've talked about using the conversations about AI data. There's so much going on, but I really want to know, like, what are some of the things that we could implement using technology to improve women's access to healthcare? Like simple things that could be easily implemented.
So you would be surprised how much technology has evolved. Artificial intelligence can be used for screening lung cancer, for breast cancer. There are thermal technologies, which is a very small device that can be used to screen large populations with very, very low costs. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, data and science has to evolve as much as the technology mm-hmm. has evolved. But in India, in Pakistan, we are using these thermal technologies to screen multiple thousands of patients. So they don't have to go through a mammogram, let's say.
Okay.
And this can be brought closer to the home. Again, can be available at the primary healthcare centers so that you can screen women. And those who are found with some kind of a chance of having a disease can then be taken for a proper examination such as a mammogram. So, you know, femtech is really, changing the way we can do mass screening at low cost and at high efficiency and effectiveness. And that's something that's already there. It's mm-hmm. existing. So I feel, and there is a lot of work happening around fertility in femtech, around reproductive health in femtech. Again, most of the femtech are run by women. So you can see how the focus is actually in femtech is all about women's healthcare, and that's sort of changing the lives by making healthcare accessible, fast, and easy. And that's what's needed for a women-centered cancer care approach or women-centered healthcare approach.
Oh. That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Adipti, for sharing your thoughts and also some of the things that Roche is doing to help improve women's access and care for healthcare in general. So thank you so much, Adipti. I really appreciate you spending some time to talk to us about the work that Roche is doing to improve women's healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Cynthia. Bye-bye.